Today is Wednesday, May 10th, 2017 at 10:42 in the morning. This is John Williams, and this is Playing Politics, a weekly podcast recorded at the studios of WCCO Radio in Minneapolis. If you're not listening to this right now, it's startribune.com/opinion. You can always hear it there. We post it on the WCCO Radio Facebook page, and portions of this are broadcast on my afternoon show on WCCO Radio.
I'm John Ratch, columnist and editorial writer for the Star Tribune.
I'm Jill Burkham. I'm an editorial writer for the Star Tribune.
Jill, welcome to the podcast. Always a pleasure to have you on board.
Thank you.
And a pleasure to read you, too. I'm going to ask you questions specifically about national health care and what that means to Minnesotans. But let's start with the story everybody is talking about today, this morning, and that is yesterday, Donald Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. John, I'll bet you were surprised, at least at the timing of this.
I wasn't the only one who was surprised. By all reports, the FBI director himself was addressing colleagues in Los Angeles, saw it up on a TV screen, and thought it perhaps was a practical joke. Certainly the laugh was not lost on anyone in the respect that it was very real, and I think he and the whole nation was surprised, particularly because the FBI is involved in an investigation, as everyone knows, in the Trump campaign's potential allegations that perhaps they were involved with Russia regarding the 2016 election. And so when you have an ongoing election like that, and then the leader of the FBI is fired, that's going to surprise nearly everyone, including a lot of people in the administration, by all reports.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Jill? I mean, they said, well, this was due to the way James Comey handled the Hillary Clinton investigation, and maybe his statement to Congress, they bungled that, but they welcomed that on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I think that it's wishful thinking if people are going to believe the excuse that was put out. I'd also like to note something that we talked about this morning at the editorial board in reaction to this news, and that is just the disappointment in people saying, you know, like Senator Chuck Grassley saying that we should suck it up and move along. This is a big deal for this country. I don't think it should be a partisan issue that you have concerns about whether or not there was meddling in our election, that there was influence buying at the highest levels. And I think that the perception, at least for a good chunk of the country, is that there's suspicious activity here. The firing of Comey and its timing, I think, added or heightened concerns. And so I really do think that those who have who believe, you know, that we need to get to the bottom of this, that there are a lot of us, and I think that we believe it's for the best, for the future of our country, that we answer the questions that this firing raises. And I don't think that calls to move along are going to be well met.
And John and Jill, if the idea for President Trump was to move this off the agenda by firing him, he only fired up, I think, the debate in terms of Democrats and increasingly some Republicans who are saying that this indeed does confirm the case that we need an independent prosecutor to look into this. This, of course, is dominating the headlines, not just nationally, but internationally as well. And so the very thing that he did not want, which was an independent prosecutor, may in fact be the result of this firing of the FBI director. So, you know, it appears to be impulsive in terms of President Trump being deeply displeased over the continued focus on Russia, but it may only amplify that focus.
Well, not only did Comey not know, it doesn't sound like any of the White House communications team knew either. I mean, the Sean Spicer show is kind of tragicomic to begin with, but he was really off guard yesterday. He's not doing, by the way, the White House press briefing today, but he didn't know what he was talking about yesterday.
There's a striking story about that where, you know, he is talking outside the White House, and he is insistent that they turn off the lights from the camera. He will not talk, and he's standing in the dark up against some bushes. And there's, you know, a whole metaphorical aspect of this of, you know, people being kept in the dark about what is really happening in terms of the president's decision here and what the eventual impact is. So you can imagine that this is going to, as you mentioned, dominate not just today's press conference, but those in the future as well. And I do think it's actually notable that they're bringing Sarah Huckabee out there to do the press conference today as opposed to Sean Spicer. And I don't know if that suggests the displeasure of the president with him or the fact that they think she might be a more effective spokesperson for such a really hot issue.
And I'd just like to add, you know, I think that there have been concerns since Donald Trump took office about the competency and the communication, the lack of coordination here with Spicer's office and the In the Bush interviews certainly added to the questions about that. And the other thing I think it heightens questions about is who's really running things. I mean, you have a large staff, but it seems to be, you know, a small group of advisors that really have influence and are making decisions among themselves, perhaps without vetting them with the resources that they have in the office. That doesn't make much sense to me.
And just on
top
of that.
Well, Jill, it makes me wonder who. Go ahead, John.
No, I was just going to say, just on top of that, normally you would bring in key congressional allies as well and bring them on board so there's a unified Washington frontier on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue with, you know, the Senate and House leaders, particularly because the Republicans control, you know, both portions of Congress. And that doesn't seem to have happened either. So it certainly left some representatives and senators flat-footed in terms of the news and trying to react to it, which added to both the confusion and some of the mixed messages emanating from Washington.
Well, what happens to the FBI investigation now? Because the president will appoint a new FBI director, right? And so,
and doesn't that,
that
raise questions? He gets to appoint the guy that's going to lead the investigation against him.
So won't that person have to recuse himself from that because he will be serving at the behest of the president? So that looks tainted from the get-go, doesn't it, Jill? So then if the head of
I wouldn't
the
FBI disagree with you on that, yes.
The president might. So then, all right, so then the FBI director is going to recuse himself from an FBI investigation. In my world, that's what would happen. So then maybe the assist, you know, so then who's in charge of the FBI, at least as a figurehead, who's in charge of the FBI investigation? And how thorough or rigorous will it be if the president has just appointed his guy to head up the FBI? Back to your point, John, that makes you all the more interested in a special prosecutor or a special investigator, right?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there should indeed be a bipartisan call for this. And this does not presume that anyone has done anything untoward. You know, certainly the Trump administration and key officials there have been vehement in their denials that there was any kind of coordination with Moscow's meddling in the 2016 presidential election. And that indeed may be the case. But clearly there's enough circumstantial evidence, the FBI and early indications from Senate and House investigative panels believe that this is worth pursuing. And so you're right. When you fire the individual leading the organization, investigating your administration, and then you're responsible for appointing the next director, that is going to be looked at, I think, you know, very seriously by many up on Capitol Hill. And you mentioned quickly recusal a few minutes ago. Let's not forget that the Attorney General of the United States, former Senator Jeff Sessions, had recused himself from anything that has to do with Russia because he had not truthfully acknowledged that he had met with the Russian ambassador while he was a spokesperson for the Trump campaign. And yet he was involved in this in terms of one of the supportive letters to President Trump that was offered as justification for the firing of Mr. Comey. So, you know, while he said he recused himself, he certainly was directly involved in the entire process that went down yesterday.
You know, I think if you're a Trump supporter, you know, you want your guy to succeed. We all want the president to succeed. And I don't think anyone can really admit truthfully to themselves that there isn't a perception problem going on here and that we need to clear it up. So the special prosecutor is certainly, it's hard to argue against. And all assurances that, well, we're going to get a great FBI, you know, head to replace Comey is reassuring, but there's already damage that's done. And the other thing I would keep an eye on, too, is, yes, I do think that the call for a special independent prosecutor needs to be strong and steady. But there was also news last night that CNN broke regarding some subpoenas that are supposedly that reportedly are being issued to associates of Michael Flynn. That's their fired NSA advisor. And you know how that I guess perhaps even obviates the need for a special prosecutor is unclear to me. It may be that this process is already rolling, that perhaps Comey set it up, knowing that he was going to be fired. But I wouldn't argue against the need for a special prosecutor, but I would be very watchful as the news develops over the next couple of days about what is the fallout from a process that's already taking place with the grand jury.
Well, Lori, we don't need a special prosecutor because in paragraph 2 of the president's letter to the former FBI director, he said, "While I greatly appreciate you informing me on 3 separate occasions that I am not under investigation, I nonetheless concur with the judgment of the Department of Justice that you are not able to effectively lead the Bureau." So 3 separate times, I guess, Comey told Trump that he's not under investigation. I wasn't aware of that. If that's public knowledge, I wasn't counting them. But what do you make of that paragraph, guys?
That no one was aware of that specific aspect of it as well, and that President Trump felt it very clearly important to mention it and to mention it in triplicate in terms of the 3 times that reportedly the FBI director has said that. Now, we have not heard that directly from the FBI director, the now fired Mr. Comey, so, you know, it's uncertain if that is the correct interpretation of you know, how he felt about the investigation.
Oh, that's
here.
Interesting. Comey hasn't validated that statement, huh?
You know, he hasn't spoken to the press at all, I think, you know,
not
since
that I'm aware of.
This happened, and he may certainly today, but he, as previously mentioned, was caught very off guard and you know, did not hold a press conference at that point, but that'll certainly be a key question that will be, you know, asked in many different ways, you know, when and if he does hold some kind of a press conference or an interview with a news organization.
I wonder if it's appropriate for the president to even say that. I mean, this is a publicly released letter. Isn't that kind of pulling back the curtains? And do we believe what the president is saying anyway?
Well, if it's true, then what's the harm of asking harder questions and continuing the investigation?
You know, Jill makes a good point. If indeed there's nothing there, as President Trump and his colleagues in the White House say, then they should not only not fight further investigation, they should want to get this off of the agenda because unquestionably, and I think they would agree on this, this is slowing whatever progress they hope to be able to accomplish in Washington here. These continued questions swirling around the president and his administration make it harder to advance his agenda. And he expressed frustration, as we talked about in previous podcasts, with not being able to move things quite as quickly as perhaps he anticipated, particularly as he came to the symbolically important 100-day mark. So, you know, this action with Mr. Comey is only going to slow those kinds of efforts.
Sally Yates told the administration that she feared that General Flynn would be compromised or could be compromised. For 18 days, they sat on that before they finally did something about it. What do we all think about that? Is that significant or is that not such a big deal?
I think that we need some answers about that. Some clarity would be helpful. I think during that time period, there was a lot of access to top secret information that Flynn would have had in that position. So we need to do some damage assessment if that happened. And I think that Trump owes people an explanation for why they ignored Ms. Yates' warning. And, you know, what his decision-making was and finally in keeping Flynn on and then finally deciding to fire him.
Well, all of our suspicion about the president notwithstanding, maybe we should just for one last minute here sort of do a little analysis of the logic train that the president is on. For instance, do we think that Comey bungled the Hillary Clinton investigation by at least sending that letter to Congress on October 27th? That was a mistake. He should not have done that. I mean, you would agree with me that there's something to that notion, right? That was a mistake by the FBI director to just before the election say we're going to look further into Hillary Clinton's email, not knowing what's in there. That may have been a mistake, right?
Particularly in context that there already was discussion underway, evidently, with investigative organizations like the FBI about the entire Russia question. So if just a very short time before an incredibly consequential national election, you come forward with this information about Secretary Clinton and do not concurrently disclose that there are questions also being asked about the Trump campaign in terms of Russian interference in the U.S. election, that seems to be tilting the scales, you know, unnecessarily. And so I do think that that was inappropriate.
Okay, so fair enough. And while the president was happy to take that as a favor to him, maybe in the back of his mind, he or any of us knew that that was a mistake. So now the president is in office. It is still fair, if maybe a little hypocritical, of the president to say that Comey bungled the investigation by saying that they were looking into Hillary Clinton's email. I mean, it was still a mistake. The president may have flip-flopped on that, but he's not on the wrong side of history now, is he?
No, I think that that's a fair point. However, the timing also leaves us suspicious. If that was really his concern, wouldn't he have done it before now? So I've not heard a good explanation on the timing.
On the timing.
Yeah.
And,
John,
and indeed, he has praised James Comey, did very publicly on the campaign trail, for making the tough choice and the right choice, and made it a you know, end of the campaign component of his massive rallies that he held. So,
yeah.
You know, you mentioned that he's changed. It's been a 180-degree change in terms of what he thought of James Comey doing that right before the election, and what he apparently thought about it yesterday regarding the letters that were offered as justification for firing the
FBI
director.
And I'd just like to add, there's this false equivalency going on here that I've seen in some of the president's tweets this morning. He's saying, well, Democrats were critical of Comey, too. They were. They are. They should have been, given the email situation with Clinton. However, there's a big jump between being critical of Comey and then firing him when he's leading the investigation into you.
Yeah, right.
I would just like to make that very clear.
I know, because both things can be true. The Democrats can be right in saying that Comey made a mistake, and they can also be right in saying that the president was wrong to fire him now.
Well, then fire him in such a nasty way, too. The bodyguard dropped off a letter. Comey's out in California. He heard about it on TV. You know, I think a public servant such as James Comey deserved a better treatment by the president after years of public service.
So, John, I wonder what the immediacy of it is. And maybe it is that those subpoenas were going out. Was something going to happen today that they wanted Comey out of the office today? I mean, I wonder if it was very specific.
Is one of many angles of the story that needs to be delved in deeper. But it appears the timing of the letters that were offered as justification were incredibly close to the actual event of the firing of Mr. Comey, meaning this wasn't a case that had been built up, at least according to the dating of the letters, for weeks or months where they were trying to figure out, you know, how to proceed with the FBI director. This appears that perhaps this is something President Trump wanted to have happen and have happen immediately, and then these letters came forward with some kind of justification. So, you know, I think that those are key questions in terms of the timing of the event, why specifically yesterday, and also how quickly this maybe have come together.
And I've heard people raise questions about whether this was just an impulsive move. He got angry after watching the hearings with Yates and Clapper. But I also think that Donald Trump is a very smart guy, and he had to know what kind of backlash that this would create. So I guess I'm not willing to buy the impulsive argument, but I do think that a question raised by a lot of analysts is did he decide that the backlash it's okay to go through? That's a price he's willing to pay to prevent something else. And I'm not the only person asking this question, but certainly it's been one that I've been mulling this morning.
Yeah, he's not just Teflon-coated. I mean, he does get away with everything. So while this will seem suspicious and people will be angry, he's titanium-coated. He just seems to be able to plow ahead. And I don't know if he's, quote-unquote, getting his way, but he's still president, and there's still people that support him, including some Republicans in Congress.
Well, and I would like to call them titanium enablers then, because when they're not doing their job, when they're not being a check and balance, then he does get to get away with this. And it sets an important and troubling precedent. So I would really like to see Congress fulfill its traditional role and ask these hard questions and put the good of the nation, you know, forefront on their agenda list.
The Washington Post just tweeted that Comey had just asked for more money for the Russian investigation. Coincidence? Probably. I'll bet it was more than just that, the lingering stigma of the investigation. But they're putting that out there, too. We're going to get it in dribs and drabs here. By the way, speaking of the job of Congress, so we're also supposed to be working on a budget, and we're also supposed to be working on healthcare 2.0. Jill, what is, at least from your view, the status of the healthcare bill?
Well, let's do a quick refresher here. So the U.S. House recently passed, by the thinnest of margins, a revised healthcare bill known as the American Healthcare Act. And that now sends it to the U.S. Senate, where that chamber must take it up. And so it's important to note that despite the Rose Garden ceremony about the U.S. House passage, that, Trump Care is not the law of the land yet. In fact, there's a long way to go before that happens. And so now the Senate is going to take this up. And they have a group of 13. I've read some tweets that this is now being expanded because there wasn't a woman on the group. But they are going to take a run at dealing with the bill that the House sent. And there's, I think, a lot of consensus that they're going to try to water down some of water down the bill that the House sent. And by watering down, I would say they will probably reinsert some of the consumer protections that were lost in the House bill. For example, I think that they will bolster some of the protections for people with pre-existing conditions that were watered down in the House bill. The thing that I have told colleagues to keep an eye on, though, is that the House bill passed more than $800 billion worth of cuts to the Medicaid program. This, of course, pays for the health care of about 30 million children, and also the bulk of long-term care for the elderly and the disabled. And the thing to watch, I think, is, if the Senate is willing to agree to these Medicaid cuts, that would be a dramatic change to a program that millions of people rely on. And I think that we need to keep an eye on this, because if they're willing to take that much out of the program and cap the contribution that the federal governments give to states for this, that this bill, this AHCA, really has become a very sneaky form of entitlement reform.
What do you mean by that, entitlement reform?
Well, we've talked about in various budget discussions that we've had in the past, everybody agrees that the main places that the federal government spends money on are programs that are known as entitlements. These include Social Security, and then there's Medicare, which mainly pays for medical care for those 65 and older. And then there's Medicaid. And Medicaid pays for the long-term care costs that Medicare doesn't cover, but it also covers poor families. So that's why it covers the medical care of so many children. And during the debate over a grand bargain, there was a consensus that we need to rein in the cost of these three programs. They're very expensive, but they're also very popular, and nobody on both sides of the aisle is willing to talk about what we can do. And until we actually make changes in these programs, the cuts that are made to the budget are really just making trims around the fringe of the budget. They're small, not meaningless cuts, but they're small cuts that really don't do much to deter the long-term debt problem that we do have in the United States. And so, taking this much out of Medicaid, but kind of, doing it behind the cover of the changes to the individual market that are being talked about in the AHCA is very concerning. And I think that we need to be very certain that these cuts are the right policy for the United States, especially as the aging wave of baby boomers is going to need long-term care. And I think that we need to be very transparent about what the Senate is doing. So keep your focus on this long game that is being played with Medicaid right now.
And I think they're not describing it as Medicaid reform or Social Security reform or Medicare reform,
right?
But it's going to end up doing those if we don't pay attention. Maybe it should, but then how do you do it is the question.
Right. Yeah, and there are implications for Minnesota here. We have a program in Minnesota called MinnesotaCare that helps people who make too much to afford to qualify for Medicaid. We help them get medical care. And a lot of the money, in fact, the bulk of it right now after the ACA's passage to pay for MinnesotaCare comes from the federal government. If these Medicaid cuts go through, that will leave the state back on the hook for MinnesotaCare, and we'll probably have to make changes in the program. Like one of the things that we did under the ACA is we lifted a hospitalization expense cap of $10,000. Of course, that doesn't get you very far these days. And so if we have to go back to that in order to meet state budgetary concerns, this is a very big change for the Minnesotans who rely on this very important program.
Go ahead, John. What were you thinking?
Another thing to keep an eye on is in the shorter term, and Jill is absolutely right, in the longer term implications of this bill and of the broader debate in Washington, but on a much shorter basis, we will soon have the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, scoring, as they call it, of the bill that was passed by the House. And if that indeed comes forward and is you know, as negative as the previous scoring on the first attempt by the House to do this, that could not only impact the debate in the Senate, but also leave some vulnerable House members, you know, in really a much more tenable position, because if they voted for a bill that shows millions of Americans who will lose health care and the impact to the budget, and the Senate, you know, steps back from that bill and takes their time, some suggest all the way through the 2018 election, to come forward with their bill, that's going to be really difficult for some of those House members, including some who are right here in Minnesota.
Will you guys comment on the Eric Paulson letter? He wrote an op-ed, I presume a guest op-ed in the Star Tribune, in which he said that this will return control back to the states, and he touted its virtues. 564 people have commented since he wrote that on that specific op-ed piece. What about all of that, Jill?
Well, one of the things that he says is that this is going to be patient-centered again, and I wish that the OPEX would have gone more into what exactly that means. By patient-centered, are more people going to have to pay more under this bill? Likely, yes. Are people with pre-existing conditions going to find it much harder and much more expensive to find care? Yes. Are people without money going to have to scrounge and put money into health savings accounts? Yes. Is that what he means by patient-centered? I would love to know that, because he's been very vague in providing assurances about what this bill does. And it's also important to note that Eric Paulson has made a very powerful enemy by the name of Andy Slavitt. Andy is a Minnesotan who used to work for Optum, I believe. And then ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Obama administration. And Slavitt has written numerous op-exes. He's doing town halls right now. But I believe he lives in Paulson's district, and he has been particularly pointed in his criticism of Paulson. And, of course, Slavitt has a huge following on social media. So it's going to be very interesting to see how all of this plays out. I think there was some speculation that Slavitt might want to run against Paulson in 2018. He said no, but I think his energy has certainly inspired others, such as Dean Phillips, to announce that they are willing to take Paulson on in what had been considered a pretty safe seat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we should defer to the American Medical Association and the AARP and the American Lung Association and the American Insurance Association, and every entity that has any skin in this game has come out against this bill. I don't know what to make of that. I'm trying not to fall into some partisan trap, like maybe they are lobbying on behalf of the money that they're going to get, and that's the problem. So I don't want to be overly swayed by that, but doggone it, that looks persuasive to me.
And so, again, you know, in Eric Paulson's piece, I don't think he necessarily explained why he was willing to disregard the advice of these trusted organizations. And I hear your concerns, John, about, you know, these are organizations who belong to an industry, and, you know, their revenue comes from providing health care services. So, yes, cuts are going to affect their bottom lines. But I'd like to believe that there's more to it than this. Physicians take a Hippocratic oath. Nurses, work long hours, work very hard to care for their patients. I don't believe it's just about the bottom line. I think they truly believe that the AHCA bill that was passed by the House is going to harm their patients. And I think that when all of them are speaking in unison, that we shouldn't dismiss them as, you know, members of the U.S. House did in passing this legislation.
I just wonder, I'll just say this as we get close to the close of this podcast, that if Republicans don't have the unfortunate task of trying to carry the ball for a president who, on the tax bill, on the AHCA, on the handling of the FBI director, doesn't really know what he's doing. He's not well-read, and he doesn't always seem that vested in the process. So he tweets out something or says something or pushes an agenda that is flawed from the get-go, a thinking, a strategy, an agenda, and there's there trying to patch it up as it goes along. And at the end of the day, at best, you pass bad policy or you reinforce bad decisions, but they have no other choice because it's Donald Trump driving the bus. And I don't know when we're going to get past that. The New Yorker magazine last issue ran a lengthy piece about the processes that could end in Donald Trump's dismissal before the term is up. And you just wonder if at some point we have to pause and say, this guy cannot lead this country. What a grand statement by me, but I don't know. Do you guys have any reaction to that?
That I think that, you know, when you talk about the processes that happen, at least in terms of bills, on the shorter point, you know, unless they move forward with this health bill in the Senate and he signs it, that's going to have a direct impact on the tax bill that you referenced as well, because reportedly one of the big pushes and the hurry up on the House was to get this done so they can move toward taxes. And on the longer aspect of it, you know, there are all sorts of challenges that await this president. Policy, absolutely, but politics for sure, and going full circle in our conversation with this Russian conversation. It's too early to tell what exactly it amounts to. Many people say nothing, and that indeed may be the case. But, you know, it does not look like a way to effectively govern a nation, have it coalesce around an idea, let alone policies, and to move it forward. So, you know, as far as the prospects of what happens with President Trump, I think that time and history, as always, will tell that. As far as the prospects in the upcoming election, it certainly is going to be quite a consequential one, and especially if things continue to have such a sense of upheaval as they've had in the first few months of the administration.
And John, you're willing to go from point A to point B a lot faster than I am. I think one of the you know, this underscores the need for an independent investigation of potential ties to Russia from Trump associates. So let's start asking questions. Let's continue to gather information. At some point, we may need to take that up. And I'm going to, you know, continue to trust the people that we've put in office that they want the good, you know, they want to do things for the good of the country and that they will put this first.
I'm on point Q, by the way. I went from A to Q. But don't you sympathize at least with the dilemma that the Eric Paulsons are faced with as a result of this?
No, I don't sympathize with it. I think you do what's right. And if you have to pay a price or you get pushback, too bad. You do what's right. No, I don't sympathize at all.
Okay, kids, that's the end of the podcast from my perspective. Any last comments from you about all of this?
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting to see if the Russia situation sucks all the oxygen out of the Senate when it comes to health care. So I don't think they were in any hurry to rush it through because it's not a good bill and they know it. But this might give Mitch McConnell an excuse to kind of, you know, slide it to the back burner even further than perhaps he had intended.
What about you, John Rash?
From one capital to another, we're talking about the gridlock in Washington. It's certainly happening in St. Paul as well. So I think that in the next few weeks on these Playing Politics podcasts, we're going to talk about the end of the session and maybe the beginning of talk of a special session unless the governor and GOP legislative leaders are able to come together.
I don't know who to be angry at on that. When the governor simply says, I won't sign that, don't bring it here, and they say, we're the duly elected legislative body, here's what we want, who's supposed to give on that, you know?
They're supposed to compromise, which is the way that the system works. And, you know, so far there doesn't seem to be a significant sign of that from either side.
Yeah, we have co-equal branches of government. One side doesn't get to govern as a majority, so...
Well put. Okay, thank you, guys. I'm John Williams. That's Jill Burkham, editorial writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You hear John Rash, by the way, on Dave Lee's show in the mornings on WCCO Radio. If you're not currently listening to this, it's startribune.com/opinion. Listen to it there. You can also find it on the Facebook page of WCCO Radio. Portions of this are broadcast at 3:40 on my WCCO Radio afternoon show. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.